Live from London, you're with Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk TNT.
Good morning and welcome to Tuesday's edition of the Sonia Poulton Show on today's News Talk. I hope this finds you beautifully well. On today's show, we get ready for liftoff as the Rwanda bill is set to become law. We also ask, why do the British public have so little faith in the police? And we meet the man who may have unlocked the secrets to happiness. And good morning to Lucy and Jeff. They wrote just a quick email to say your show has gone from something we watched when we could to being our breakfast go-to. This is just to let you and your team know we appreciate all the work you are putting in. You will get your wish to take on the mainstream. Now that's my kind of language. So yesterday, one of the UK's most famous newsreaders, Hugh Edwards, resigned from his job at the BBC because of medical advice, we were told. Really? It's taken 9 months to reach this point since one of Britain's most famous newsreaders was accused last year of paying a young person for sexually explicit pictures. The BBC made the announcement that he was leaving on health grounds, although there was no mention of the allegations that he sent more than £35,000 to a teenager in return for sexually explicit images. This was said to have happened over a period of 3 years, so clearly this was far from a one-off. Parents of the young person blew the whistle to the Sun newspaper after the BBC did not take seriously their complaints. The Sun ran with the story, which set off huge speculation who it was, because the BBC personality was anonymous in the story. It was Hugh Edwards' wife, Vicky, who revealed it was her husband, and she said he was suffering mental health issues. It was serious accusations against him that he had given the teen the money over 3 years, and the teen had used it to fund a crack habit. Yes, it's sordid, but the police have said that no criminal offence had been committed by the presenter in this case. After the initial allegations, three more people made allegations against Hugh Edwards. The child's mother, who made the first shocking allegations in May last year, told The Sun she felt sick whenever she saw the man on TV. Hugh Edwards, of course, was one of the BBC's highest paid newsreaders. He was in the pay bracket of £435,000 a year to £439,000. That was for the year 2022-2023. And that was according to the BBC's most recent annual report. Since the story broke last year, his £500,000 salary has continued, even though he has not. The public announcement is his departure at his own request, but I know for a fact that there is relief across the BBC that this situation has finally been resolved. It's outrageous that the BBC did not take action before and that they continued to pay Mr. Edwards money from the controversial broadcasting licence fee funded by the British public. BBC newsreaders are trusted around the world. It's the brand. You don't have to trust them, but they are trusted, believe me. But you can't have one of the most trusted men in Britain who was chosen to deliver such messages as the Queen's death, to report on the coronation, turning out to be some seedy git who funds a kid's drug habit, allegedly. So the things that I know about Hugh Edwards, I can't stand him, frankly. I'm just being honest. Clean hands and all that. He was a major pusher of lockdown narrative. And yet it is alleged he breached lockdown rules several times, including to meet a 23-year-old that he had met on a dating app, while at the same time telling millions of people to follow the rules as part of the COVID fear-mongering campaign. Perhaps Edwards, like all the other rule breakers, Boris Johnson, Matt Hancock, Mr. Model himself, Neil Ferguson, who also got caught with his pants down, metaphorically speaking, during C19 lockdown, perhaps the reality is that none of them obeyed orders because they had no fear of any pandemic. And that's my biggest problem with them. Edwards leaves with immediate effect, but is not known if the BBC's internal workplace investigation into whether Edwards brought the corporation into disrepute has completed. Personally, I have to laugh. The internal inquiry into whether Hugh Edwards had brought the broadcaster into disrepute just is ridiculous. This is the same broadcaster that employed Jimmy Savile, where staff were absolutely complicit in sexual assaults. And when two of its own journalists wanted to expose Savile, the BBC shut it down. So no, as sordid and nasty as these alleged revelations are about Hugh Edwards, it has not dragged the BBC into disrepute, but merely confirmed what most of us already know about the corporation. It's full of overpaid, overprivileged, entitled presenters and people made to believe that they are special stars who behave one way while telling the rest of us to live another way. Generally, the marital affairs of the rich and famous are of no concern to me, but these allegations are different. Hugh Edwards is a public figure, and we are talking about clearly a troubled teen with an alleged drug habit. Something is very, very nasty there. And this, of course, is from the man who held a moral high ground over national affairs for decades. This is at least rank hypocrisy. Now, on today's show, let us ask our question of the day. I've already asked it on X, and we want to know, what institutions do you still have faith in? Let me read some of the comments that have been posted on X. None, says Rachel. It's all broken, and I suspect that was the plan all along. COVID was the Trojan horse to bring in what is happening now. I just wish people would see it and reject the New World Order. And on that note, let's find out about the UK headlines from Gemma Cooper.
Our lines are open. From the US and Canada, call 1-888-201-6425. From the UK, call 033-0024-1026. And from Australia and New Zealand, call 1-800-670-310. Free speech is alive and well on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And welcome back. And another comment, not the Met Police UK, that's for sure, says Craig Campbell on X. Welcome, Gemma. Good morning. It's Tuesday.
Hi, Sonia. I see you got the memo, red for danger, both of us, the ladies in red this morning. Must be something in the air, eh?
Yes, a full moon, I believe, in Scorpio. Very powerful. So maybe that's what it is. Sometimes things just happen without you being conscious of it, right, Jen?
Absolutely. And I must comment on the Hugh Edwards story, saga, scandal. I mean, they've got away with it, the BBC. I mean, this story broke late yesterday on the last show that I was on TNT. I just managed to get it in on the Freeman report that Hugh Edwards had gone. But it's the quietness of the whole thing. Okay, he's gone under medical grounds, nothing to see here. Not least withstanding, the BBC had to do its own internal investigation. It was supposed to be anyway, into members of staff at the corporation that had complained about his behaviour, predatory, uncomfortable comments, abuse of power effectively within the newsroom. That was supposed to have been going on. None of it will come out now because he's gone. And I know through the grapevine, because that's my old stomping ground, my old employer, where I was hung out to dry just for going to a few anti-lockdown marches, he wanted to stay. He was angry at the way he'd been treated. This shows the level of contempt in which these people in these positions hold the audience. He thought he hadn't done anything wrong. He couldn't believe it. I know that I've heard so many of these things have it trickled a little bit into the public domain, but I do know a little bit more, as I'm sure you do, Sonia, as an ex-mainstream person. But what's happened to that internal investigation? What's happened to those staff members that were brave enough to come forward and speak to their line managers at the BBC, which is never an easy thing to do if you're complaining about a fellow staff member, a colleague, especially one as senior as Hugh Edwards? It's all been hushed up again. It's all been hushed up and brushed under the carpet, and we're paying for it, of course. Telling us one thing and doing another behind our backs. None of it is being held, and the corporation's not really being held to account. I looked at some of the comments following some of the mainstream coverage yesterday. I thought, let's see what the mood is in the UK about this, given the level of money he was on for almost a year, suspended on full pay. And a lot of people are really sympathetic to him. This shows the level of brainwashing that these institutions still hold. They say, oh, it's a private matter. The poor man, he was so lovely. But he was paying a vulnerable person, a drug addict. No one's easier to manipulate than an addict when they want a fix. He was using his power, his money, he's all right. He's a good guy. I mean, how people can't see through the image of what these corporations present, but people couldn't see through Savile, you know, the amount of people that clutched their pearls in horror when the revelations about Savile came out, including friends of mine. I was like, no, it's not what you think. So we got a long way to go before people completely lose trust in public institutions like the BBC, like the Met Police. You know, if you're listening, watching, engaging with TNT, you already know, you know. But we still got work to do in kind of taking on these monoliths. And I think hats off to Victoria Derbyshire, who's another high profile BBC presenter and journalist. She was the one that took up the mantle on behalf of her fellow co-workers. A lot of them went to her. She's got a reputation for kind of sticking up for the underdog. And she's brought a lot of hard hitting sexual abuse scandal stories to the BBC, including the ones about the footballer and the footballers who were abused by Barry Bennell. She really pushed for that to be featured on the Beeb. She took up the case for junior co-workers. Where's that gone? You know, we should try and get Victoria Derbyshire onto this show and talk to her, you know, girl power and all that. But yeah, there's a lot more to that story than meets the eye. And it's all gone very quiet. And the BBC's heaving a huge sigh of relief this morning, I should imagine.
Really important to get that insight from you, Gemma, because obviously, as you say, you were at the BBC. And yes, it's all gone quiet for a reason. There's information that they simply do not want the public to know about. And it is our duty. People are forced to buy that license fee. They are literally forced if they want to be able to watch live programming, which is absolutely outrageous. And for him to still continue to receive his almost half a million salary over those 9 months is just says everything you need to know, really, doesn't it? Absolutely everything. And I am not a fan of the CERN, not by a long shot, but I'm actually glad that the story was broken. It needed to be broken. And it tells you something, sadly, about the individual, that they were so sort of brainwashed by the whole situation that they were really like, they were against their parents for whistleblowing. So yeah, it says a lot, really, doesn't it? And I hate that overprivileged, over-entitled madness that comes from being a presenter. We don't have any of that nonsense around here. Everybody's on the same level around here, as indeed it should be, right, Gemma?
Yeah, and just on the parents as well, you know, the other thing that hasn't really been investigated properly is that the initial complaint that the parents made to the BBC was just sat on. They didn't want to follow it up. They just were like, ignored it. Hopefully this will go away. You know, there was a working class family. So we're not talking about a complaint from an elite businessman or somebody who runs a corporation. We're talking about a complaint from a family from South Wales, you know, which is a notoriously poor working class area. I think they thought, oh, this will go away. And of course it didn't. Picked on the wrong family. And of course that's why they blew the whistle. And the BBC had handled it properly, none of this would have come out. You know, that's an organisation that's just no longer fit for purpose. But people yesterday, I was quite sad to see it, actually. They're like, oh, leave him alone. He's all right. He's done nothing wrong. I was like, well, OK, well, that's the benchmark of which we're still fighting in this war on consciousness. You know, I just wish people would wake up quicker. But there we go. Anyway, onto some headlines today. Obviously, the long-awaited Rwanda bill has been passed. I think it was just after 1:30 in the morning, ping-ponging between the House of Lords and Commons. It passed last night. It will now become law once it's achieved royal assent by King Charles III. And the plane should be taking off by late June, early July. Many people this morning, though, including lots of migrants at Dover who have come over, and there's a boat. It was filmed coming over not long after this bill was passed. They say it won't deter us. We're still going to come. And many opposition leaders, including Richard Tice of Reform UK, he's saying it won't act as a deterrent. We'll have to see. Staying with Rishi Sunak, he's heading to Poland today to meet his Polish counterpart, Donald Tusk, and to pledge this $500 million extra to Ukraine on top of the $2.5 billion he's already promised in this financial year. That's to go to Ukraine. Another $500 million on top of that. We wish it was going to people in this country, don't we, Sonia? And a disturbing report is also out today saying that children under the age of 6, some as young as 3, are being coerced online with their phones and devices into performing quite graphic sexual acts. They're being groomed. Internet Watch Foundation says it's really a serious problem, with sexual predators now turning to the digital world to get their kicks. And of course, it comes after the warnings from Ofcom that a quarter of kids in the UK between the ages of 5 and 7 have got smartphones. And that's where this abuse is happening. And kids don't realise really what is going on. It's a subject we were talking about just yesterday, our addiction to digital technology. It seems the sexual predators understand exactly how to manipulate it and to capture young hearts and minds into doing actually very graphic things.
Indeed. Gemma, we've just got time for you to drill down a little bit on that Rwanda bill. We will be discussing it at more length later, but I'd be really interested on your take on this.
Well, I didn't think it was going to happen, to be honest. I really thought it would be ping pong all the way between the law, the House of Lords and the House of Commons, and eventually would kind of shuffle off. But it's gone through. And I think probably because Rishi Sunak sees this as his only real vote winner, one of the key pledges that he made at the last party conference. And it, obviously it was, you know, the plan was came out 2 years ago. It's had successive prime ministers who haven't been able to make it work. Interestingly, the Kigali hotels who've been ready for this say they've been waiting for 2 years, and some of the hotels look very pleasant. They've got nice grounds. And if this does work, there's a pool of 52,000 asylum seekers that could be deported. The most that's ever been deported in 1 year is 5,000. And this relates just to people that have come over on the boat seeking asylum that haven't arrived from a safe country. They're put into home office accommodation, which is a huge issue in the UK, and they're not allowed to get jobs. So that's the pool which we're looking at that could be deported. Now, of course, it'll be which flights, which airfield, you know, the wrangling around that. No commercial airline company wants to touch this or go near this. And there is talk about using RAF planes to take people away as soon as they touch down in Dover. So let's see what happens. I'm quite surprised myself, but there we go. It's passed. It's going to be law. All eyes will be on the skies, June and July, to see the planes taking off or not. Let's see.
I absolutely echo that. I was surprised as anything. I literally was. But on that note, we will be right back. We'll see Gemma in the second hour.
TNT's Alex Zaharoff-Roy.
They need to expand the number of places and countries that can make ARM-powered processors. And Intel has actually made chips designed with ARM designs for years. This deal will give Intel's foundries, two of which are being built in the US at a cost of $20 billion, more chips to make. Now, TSMC has received $6.6 billion from the Biden administration towards its much-delayed 3 and 4 nanometer chip foundries in Arizona. So while we went from a drought of chips during the pandemic, the second half of this decade should see even more chips being manufactured than ever before, which the world will need, considering the AI boom currently underway will need ever more computing power to satisfy the ever-growing demand.
Talking Tech with Alex Zaharoff-Reut on today's News Talk, TNT.
When a crisis hits, close to home and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve.
Keep coming, keep coming, keep coming.
The demand for charitable services has skyrocketed, and nonprofits are rising to meet the needs. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Honoring. Protecting. Caring. Inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations of all sizes, across all missions, has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. Together, we change the world. The Nonprofit Alliance.
The conversation continues.
I don't believe it, and I think that's a terrible position that I am in, that I don't trust my government.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And a reminder of our question of the day. What institutions do you still have faith in? Black Carlos Monzon on X says they can only maintain order, in quotes, with reliance on their armed backup, armed police, the army, etc. If you get robbed, burgled, physically assaulted, etc., you are a fool if you think the police are coming to help you in any quick, useful time. Well, that is interesting. And that largely echoes much of the responses we've been receiving this morning to that question. Now, polling has revealed a devastating lack of confidence in the police, with more than half of the public saying they do not trust the police to solve crimes, and over a third saying they have no faith in the authorities to maintain law and order. So the question really is, how have we arrived at this point with faith in the police at such a low? Now, one man who I know for certain who will have some thoughts on this matter is Harry Miller. He is a former police officer and co-chief of Fair Cop. Good morning to you, Harry.
Good morning, Sonia. I can't believe that we're still doing this five years later. And that the way it's gone, they appear to have got worse. And I think they appear to have got worse because, in fact, they have gotten worse, irrespective of the fact that, you know, that I had one of the greatest victories that the UK has ever seen against the police and the government. That's fantastic, but overall policing has got worse. And this latest poll, where confidence in the police is absolutely rock bottom, where there is only a 27% expectation that if you're burgled, it will result in an arrest, where there's less than 7% belief that if you're pickpocketed, it will result in arrest, where there is no expectation whatsoever from shopkeepers, from stores, that if they are shoplifted, that the police will even turn up. This is a terrible state of affairs. I remember when I was a police officer, every single day we would turn up pretty much at a shop to arrest a shoplifter. It was just part and parcel of the job. Every single day, if there was a burglary, we would be there. And this is the difference. Back in the day, God, I sound old saying that, don't I? But back in the day, if there was a burglary in progress, every police officer in the station, whether they were having their refs or not, would jump in a police car, stick on the blues and twos, and they would fly down there because they wanted to get the collar. They wanted to nab the burglar in the act. They wanted to put right the injustice, and they wanted to do their job. And the difference is now, the police officers are tasked and burdened with so many things which are not to do with policing. They're to do with wokery, they're to do with diversity and inclusion, they're to do with self-reflection, nasal gazing, and showing
and
that
all of those things.
That they don't have time to be involved in policing.
No, they don't. Let's just give people a little bit of background. Yes, I can't believe we're still here either. Of course, I was there to witness that historic win of yours at the High Court, where you essentially took, I think it was Humberside Police, to court because they were harassing you, including in your workplace, simply because you were asking very important early questions about the whole gender madness. That's what took place. And that's what you're talking about, isn't it, Harry? That we've reached this state of affairs where there is such a lack of trust in police because they are so focused on the whole woke agenda.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And of course, my battle with Humberside Police, that was the skirmish in the foothills. The real battle was won at the Court of Appeal a year or so later, when we took the government, the College of Policing, through the courts, and we won them. And we struck down the entirety of the hate crime guidance, which had been in existence in one form or another for 20 odd years. That was a major, major blow to the police. Now, the police did not take that well, it's fair to say. Rather than doing the sensible thing, backing off, having a look at themselves and going, you know what, lads, we got this entirely, entirely wrong. What they've done is they've shot off in different directions. They've become the multi-headed hydra. And now you can tell. You can tell that they operate with fear and with favour, that they favour certain groups over other groups, that they are far more keen on patrolling diversity and inclusion than they are in getting out onto the streets and policing actual crime. This is the tragedy that we are facing right now. And I think there are two reasons for this. The first reason is it goes back to the McPherson report and the death of Stephen Lawrence, the murder of Stephen Lawrence. The McPherson report said that the police were institutionally racist. Okay, so they had, at that time, a problem within their culture where they viewed black people only as criminals and perpetrators, rarely as victims. So that was problem number one. And since then, there has been this horrible residual guilt that the police have been labouring under. They don't want to get it wrong again. The second problem is the 2010 Equality Act, where certain groups have been elevated and given a protected status. And in certain respects, in an employment setting, that's entirely right. But it's not in a general setting. And the police have taken, well, they've picked and chosen aspects of the Equality Act and become champions of certain groups. So if you are pro-Palestinian, for instance, if you are pro-gender ideology, if you are pro-climate change extreme activism, if you are pro-lockdown, etc., then you will get a pass and an easy hand from the police because they...
So, Harry, you're talking about a two-tier policing that is taking place in this country, right?
That's right. And the problem with that is we all know it. Suella Braverman, who was the head of the police, she was the Home Secretary. She said that there was two-tier policing in this country. And what happened? She was sacked the following morning because we are not allowed to
I have to say, Harry, I think she was probably sacked for bringing us close to some kind of civil war in this country. But that's probably another conversation for another time. But Harry, tell me seriously, because obviously you have this great insight. What can be done, though, to improve this? So because we need the police, don't we?
Yeah, of course we need the police. And when I criticise the police, I'm talking about the higher echelons of policing. I'm not talking about the rank and file. Rank and file police officers, by and large, want to do the right thing. Now, there is a massive problem with recruiting. I know for a fact that there are a number of young police officers now, young in terms of service, not necessarily young in terms of age, who have joined because they want to be political activists. They have joined because they want to root out what they consider to be non-woke police officers. I know of one police officer who joined only 6 months ago. She's a terrible officer by all accounts. And she has openly stated that she was absolutely surprised that she needs to work weekends, that she doesn't think that she ought to be working nights, and that her sole motivation is to champion the cause of Sarah Everard. Now, that is not the reason to join the police force. The reason to join the police force is because you want to keep the king's peace, you want to uphold the law, you want to hunt down the bad guys. That is it. That is it. If you are interested in being a political activist, that is great. That's fantastic. We need more of them. Go find a job where that is appropriate. But the police force is not it.
Absolutely. Harry,
without your favour.
While we've got you in full flow, we're going to go to some quick headlines, but we will be right back. Harry, stay right there. Stay passionate. We'll be back in a second.
Great news.
The news.
We have news.
Great news.
Great news.
Great news, my friends.
Yeah! Listen. TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan with your TNT headlines. Australia's Prime Minister's lashed out at ex-boss Elon Musk as the billionaire goes into battle to protect free speech.
I just find it extraordinary that this bloke thinks he's above the law.
The UK will start detaining migrants within days after plans to send them to Africa was approved by Parliament.
No ifs, no buts. These flights are going to Rwanda.
And 10 people have been killed in a horror mid-air collision involving two military helicopters in Malaysia.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
Harry, I think I have to ask you, and I'm not going to be at all surprised by your response, but do the results of this poll surprise you?
No, they don't surprise me. What they do is they disappoint me. They shock me and they dismay me. That's my response.
Right. Thank you so much, everybody. This is Harry Miller. And I should just say, Harry, that you and I together, because of what we experienced, you and I together actually were involved in a cop being dismissed from active duty. But the amount of madness that we had to go through in order to do that, to not only protect ourselves and the public, gave us both quite an insight, didn't it?
It did. And we were successful in that we got rid of the cop from service. But that police officer should be in prison for stalking. That's what should have happened. That would have happened in any other walk of life. Had a member of the public behaved like that, they would now be serving time in jail. Simple as that.
Sober words. Sober words from Harry Miller from We Are Fair Cop. Take good care of yourself, Harry. Lovely to see you again. Now, leaked NHS figures have revealed that in just 1 year, more than 15,000 patients died whilst in the care of mental health trusts. The scale of patient deaths raises a whole raft of questions about the quality of care provided by the NHS and its mental health services. One woman who knows all about this is Julia Hooper. Cooper. She's a mother, sadly, whose son died under the care of the Essex University Partnership Trust. She's since vowed never to remain quiet about it. She joins me now. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you. And I know I was only with you the other week. We were talking about terms of reference for the statutory inquiry, and they have since arrived. They're a little bit wider, but they don't encompass what we requested, which was from our experience over years of watching deaths, what was going on in the community. And lo and behold, these figures are leaked. 15,000 community deaths. I believe these are community deaths. So the scale and the horror of that, the tragedy of that, is horrific. But we knew. What we don't have is those included yet in our terms of reference for our inquiry. So that is devastating.
It is devastating because this is very real to you. Your story is heartbreaking. As you say, you were on with us recently and it involves your son, Chris. And one of the things that you were very keen for me to understand is what had taken place with the coroner. And the coroner was really categoric. I'm going to quote the coroner, found that these vociferous, ferocious and consistent requests for appropriate treatment by Chris's mother, Julia, were not acted upon and clinicians failed to treat her as an invaluable resource in the care and treatment of her son. They let Chris down, didn't they?
They did. Christopher's life was worth nothing, absolutely nothing. Christopher was simply a unit to be processed. When people die out in the community, they usually have a 3-hour long inquest. It's very brief. Not much is learned or uncovered. The difference with Christopher's death in the community was we managed to invoke Article 2, which is quite rare for a community death. And what we saw was internal emails between these people all saying Christopher was definitely going to die unless they did something. And they didn't do anything. They met the day before he died. And the plan was to work out how to gag me because I was asking publicly, pleading for my son's life, to anybody who would listen. So we know these issues are going on everywhere, wholesale. We can't prevent them. We can't hold those people to account unless we have that in our inquiry. So after I spoke to you, I just became really ill because the weight of those already lost and those flailing and suffering and being processed like units in the community is so heavy. It really affects your health and it's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. And some of the challenges you've had to face are so incredibly painful. Both you and Melanie Leahy, who's been through a similar experience, and you're obviously working together and attempting to make the Lampard inquiry into the deaths around the Essex unit, to make it as broad as possible so it actually answers very serious questions. But this has been a struggle for you.
Every single step of the way, it's been like a sick game. So, for example, Baroness Lampard was appointed and she set up a consultation. I wasn't happy with the way it didn't reach out to certain groups who are affected by mental health. It was literally just a blanket consultation. However, those who responded made it clear that they wanted the community looking at. That was ignored. What is the point of having a consultation simply to ignore it? And we weren't able to have proper meetings with her to discuss the minutiae of those clauses that we needed to see that had been very carefully thought out. We weren't able to do that with the Health Minister, Victoria Atkins, either. It's just a sick game. We're not talking about the price of oranges. We're talking about large-scale death. It is disgusting and sick. Being on the business end of it here, it's like being annihilated. Every time there's a delay or someone has played a silly game and managed to evade progress, it's just not funny, Sonia. It's just desperate.
It is desperate. And it's obviously your experience horrendous. You know, anybody can feel some very deep compassion and sympathy with you because it's completely contrary to nature. Parents do not want to be burying their children. That is a horrendous scenario. And then to be met with this hostility that you have from the system is absolutely outrageous. What specific changes or reforms do you believe are urgently needed to prevent these further tragedies, Julia?
Well, we need to open up absolutely every component part involved, the way children are treated and educated, everything, all the way up, all the way through. We should be into everything, and we should be insisting upon a complete duty of candor. That doesn't yet exist. Can you believe it?
No.
Openness. We need to rapidly get rid of people who are up to all sorts. You would not believe what they're up to behind closed doors, falsifying evidence, hiding evidence. That's normal. Their hatred towards these patients and their families, the culture, if you can call it a culture, that allows the law not to pertain to us. So when one of us is at risk of death, and that's a criminal issue, criminal negligence of agencies, you can't contact the police, they won't do anything. You're on your own. That's what's utterly terrifying. Your young person, your loved one, will be out in the community and they only have you. The second you collapse or drop off or miss a beat, they're dead. There is no support. There is no treatment. And they will say, oh, your loved one has the right to kill themselves. Your loved one has the right to make bad decisions. Really? No. Yeah. And if that were the case, now you know that, would you be all right with that? Would you say, yeah, let that carry on? We're losing a generation.
Yes, we are. We are, absolutely. Julia, it's very easy for us to look at this from a distance, read these headlines and just go, well, that happens. You know, this is the world we live in, blah, blah, blah. But that isn't the reality. Show us, what is this like on a day-to-day basis when you have to live with this reality?
Well, like you say, I thought this would never happen to us. We were very smug. We had the perfect life. Unfortunately, it does. And when it does, it's like a tsunami that overtakes you. You're playing cat and mouse on your own. These illnesses that some of our young have are very complex. You have to be really expert to understand what's going on and to anticipate what might come next. So you're going to get no sleep. You're going to be devastated. You're going to be playing cat and mouse on your own in open view without any support. You're probably going to be ignored, lied about by services. They will lie about your young person's condition so that everything looks good on paper should they die. And you know there's a cold, hard light, and you're well aware you're totally on your own, surrounded by people, surrounded with the world carrying on. And you know when your loved one is going to die without intervention. And you're just waiting. And our young people are so beautiful. We've lost so many extraordinary, beautiful, gentle young people for want of access to basic healthcare and not to be surrounded by lying psychopaths in some cases.
Indeed. Julia, we are so desperately sorry to hear your plight. It's awful. It never gets better. Every time I hear you talk, take good care of yourself. Everybody, this is Julia Hooper. She's a barrister and she's explaining to us exactly what happens when your child takes their own life, when they are negligently being cared for by the NHS mental health services. Take care of yourself, Julia. We'll be right
back. Thank you, Julia.
My name's Stacy. I'm 57 and I was adopted in 2020.
We were adopted in 2019.
And we were adopted in 2021.
We had a house, and it sounds crazy, but it wasn't a home.
The one thing that Jake and Emma brought is it became a home.
When I met Dakota, he had just turned 14.
You weren't there for the first this and the first that. I missed the first words, but we got a lot of other firsts.
Watching her say, oh my God, I cannot believe I got my license. And she's like, I passed. And I'm like, girl.
See them grow. It is.
They chose to love us. They didn't have to. They chose us. Family.
You and you.
Kids in the middle.
What I thought was a complete life was nowhere near complete. But it is now.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org.
Meet Norm. He lives with anxiety, but with the help of this latest innovation from Be Normal, he can be normal, just like everyone else. With the swipe of a finger, you can project happiness, confidence, machismo. Why settle for being real when you can be normal? The Normal Maker. New from Be Normal.
This item doesn't really work because there's no such thing as normal. We're all different. What we like, how our brains work. In fact, 1 in 5 of us live with mental illness. Don't filter who you are. Start by talking to someone you trust. And remember, there is no normal.
Live from London with Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk TNT.
Now, joining us for a roundup of some of the day's biggest stories is political commentator Charlie Downs. Good morning to you, Charlie.
Good morning, Sonia. How's it going?
Great to have you with us. Of course, the Rwanda bill passes. Sunak says that the first deportation flights will begin in July. Do you share his confidence?
Not in the slightest, to be frank. I think what we've forgotten in the West, and in Britain in particular, is, or perhaps we've been made to forget this, is beneath all the layers of bureaucracy and administration and managerialism, when it comes to politics and particularly leadership, literally all that matters is will. All that matters is the will to achieve something. And across his embarrassing, disgraceful career as Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak has demonstrated that he is a man incapable of expressing and enacting will. Because he's essentially just an administrator. He's a bureaucrat. He's a banker. You know, he's not somebody who is actually a leader figure. So, I mean, this is demonstrated by the fact that this Rwanda bill has been in the news for what feels like, you know, years and years and years now, and nothing has changed. And today, wow, you know, it's passed through the Lords and all the rest of it. And flights are supposed to begin taking off in 10 weeks. If we were a country that had an actual leader, this would have started years ago. It wouldn't be going through this long process where it's going back and forth and people are being, you know, bullied by various different courts and conventions and all the rest of it. It would just happen. But we don't have that kind of politics in this country. We have Rishi Sunak.
Yeah, we do have Rishi Sunak. Indeed, he was placed there by the men in the dark that we don't know about, Charlie. But the thing is that he does seem, it would appear outwardly, that he's stronger on immigration, which is a major issue for Brits. But it would appear that he's stronger on immigration than Keir Starmer. So if he manages to get this up and running, do you think this is going to be a game changer for him in terms of like polling for the election?
This is the question, isn't it? Is Labour going to be even worse than the Conservatives on immigration, which I regard as the most pressing issue of our time? And I'm not just talking about illegal immigration, I'm talking about legal immigration as well. Now, Labour, I mean, obviously they have signalled that they have no intention of, you know, closing the borders or anything like that. But do I think they're going to be worse than the Conservatives? Honestly, I don't know how they could be without literally sparking a revolution in this country. I mean, how could you be worse than the Conservatives when it comes to things like immigration? If nothing else, what Labour have shown themselves to be over the last at least 30 years is a party that is actually willing to do stuff. I mean, you look at Tony Blair, for example. For whatever you might want to say about him, now personally, I think he did an incalculable amount of damage to this country. But for whatever you want to say about him, he was a leader with will. You know, he was somebody who, when he was faced with a roadblock, when he was told, no, sir, we can't do this, his response was, right, no, we can, we're going to, we just need to figure out how. Whereas with Rishi Sunak, it's, sir, we can't do this, and it's, oh, okay, I guess I'll go home with my tail between my legs. And that's just, you know, that's just not appropriate for a British leader. So, hey, we'll have to see about Labour. Personally, I have absolutely zero faith in them because Keir Starmer is the most boring, again, managerial type character you could imagine. But I guess we'll just have to see because obviously it is written that they will be elected at the next election.
It is written. That sounds like destiny, doesn't it? Yeah, don't sit on the fence there, Charlie. So here's the thing, right, is that this Rwanda thing feels very much like PR, doesn't it, really? Because what we've heard is while this has all been taking place, we've had Rwandan asylum seekers who say it's too dangerous in their own country and they've come here and they've been accepted into the asylum seeker system. We know only 1% are going to be going. And of course, this is now going to get the King's Royal Assent. But it just feels like it's not really anything truly happening. It's just to make the British people feel like something's happening.
I totally agree. And the reason for that is because, being frank, what is actually necessary when it comes to dealing with the issue of illegal migration, where we do have literally tens of thousands of people who are living in this country who shouldn't be here, who have no right to be here, who have come here illegally, the measures that are necessary to deal with that problem are not the kind of soft, cuddly, they don't conform to the soft, cuddly politics we've had for the last, you know, for the better part of 80 years, you know, since World War II. And that's, I think that makes people very uncomfortable. It certainly makes our elite class very uncomfortable. And so that's why nothing ever gets done, is this fear, this crippling fear of being called, you know, authoritarian or racist or whatever magic word you might want to choose.
Yeah, it is very, very difficult. I'm always split about this. I really am, because I also think that we have to take account of Britain's actions in other people's countries that also may contribute to people feeling forced to come here. But there's no, we literally have no justification for the small boats coming in. We don't. It is like, even me being pro-immigration, I can see that there is a problem there. So look, let us flip to another story that I think that I'm hoping you're going to be as forthright about. I'm sure you will. Well, it is the story, of course, involving the anti-Semitism protester at the weekend from the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, him happening, I say in quotes, upon a pro-Palestine march. And the Metropolitan Police, Mark Rowley, obviously top dog of the biggest police force in England and Wales, he's praised the professional conduct of the policemen involved in that encounter. Do you share the same sentiment?
It's a really interesting one, this one. I mean, looking at the footage of that incident, it doesn't look great. I mean, it's not great optics for the Metropolitan Police. But then, you know, like every other sort of institution in this country, the Metropolitan Police Force have kind of become a joke. You know, they can't enforce the law. I mean, all the while we're talking about this, teenagers are literally stabbing each other to death on the streets of London right. every single week.
Right.
And frankly, when it comes to the issue of, you know, what amounts to foreign ethnic conflicts spilling over onto British soil, the only thing I have to ask is, why the hell is this happening in the first place? Why is it that we have to be having conversations about, you know, as I said, religious ancient conflicts between peoples who have no real, you know, who are not indigenous to this country? You know, why are we having a conversation about them getting at each other in our streets? I mean, the fact of the matter is, again, to bring it back to immigration, frankly, our elite class has invited these people in, and now, you know, we're essentially reaping what they sowed. And so it's just depressing. And ultimately, my position on this, on anything related to a foreign conflict, is why can't I just take the side of my own people? Why do I have to buy into this dialectic where I have to take a side, where I have to be pro-Israel, or I have to be pro-Palestine, or I have to be anti-this and anti-that and pro-this? Why can't I just ask, well, what's in the best interest of my people? And then, and as far as I'm concerned, the best interest of my people is not being involved in these conflicts at all, whether in a foreign policy sense or in a domestic sense, because there's no good reason for this conflict to be spilling over onto the streets of London and other cities and towns in our country. Because, you know, who asked for that? Who wants that? Who wants to see that? Who wants to feel that way about their own city?
Well, I mean, these are all good questions. Many people would probably be shouting at the screen right now saying, I do. And that's why George Galloway was elected, because he's speaking up for the Palestinians. But that's another story. So, but do I take from that you would stop all foreign aid if it was down to you, including to Ukraine, including to Israel? We'd stop sending over weapons. Is that what you do? Would you go that far?
Now, I don't think it's as simple as just simply stop foreign aid, because I think that, again, since the end of the Second World War, Britain has essentially been at the beck and call of the American empire. You know, we are essentially America's whipping boy in Europe, America's enforcer in Europe. So when it comes to foreign policy matters, if you look, again, since World War II, Britain hasn't really had control of its own foreign policy. It's just done whatever America has told us to do. And so I don't think it would be as simple as just stop foreign aid. It's a far, far deeper, more fundamental issue with our system than that. Because what we would have to do in order to achieve that is extract ourselves from the influence of America. And that is a task so gargantuan, I can't even wrap my head around it.
Oh, try, because I think that might be some of the solution. And I think if you were able to wrap your head around that, you might even get me on board with that, because I agree with you. I think that Britain has been the lapdog of America for far too long. We saw that over 9/11. And so what you're saying is we need to bring back authority to our country, right? And take care of domestic issues more rather than looking all around the world. That's really your position, right?
Absolutely. I think that our country is in a situation right now where we cannot justify sticking our fingers into everybody else's business because things are in such chaos and such flux at home. You know, you walk the streets of this country and it's a completely different place to what it was 20 years ago. The streets are run down. You know, the shop fronts are boarded up. The streets are lined with it's a combination of, you know, American chain stores, fast food restaurants, tacky vape shops and Turkish barbers. And, you know, people don't feel proud of this country anymore. And rightfully so. You know, what is there to be proud of at this point? What has our culture become? And I think it's depressing. And so sending millions upon millions upon millions to Ukraine and stirring things up in Israel and that sort of thing, that's absolutely not in the interest of the British people. Absolutely not. But again, I think that the fundamental issue of our time is America, and it is American influence over our nation, because I think that that can be blamed for a lot of the problems that we're facing.
Interesting. Let me bring you to our final story. Trudy Warner, a retired social worker, was arrested on March 27th, 2023, outside in a London Crown Court. And she was carrying a sign urging the jurors to listen to their conscience. She has now, thankfully, been found not in contempt of court. What are your thoughts about that?
It's a really interesting story, this one, because, you know, quite often we'll have conversations, certainly in the kind of area of politics that you and I occupy. We have conversations quite a lot about free speech and this sort of thing. And I've come to believe that free speech is it's something that's held up as an ideal, and for good reason. But actually, it's not something that has ever really existed, and it's not something that ever really could exist.
Right.
Because what the concept of free speech presupposes is the existence of a neutral government, of a neutral state that simply exists to kind of, maintain a level playing field for everybody in the country over which it governs. And I don't think that's ever really been the case. There's no such thing really as a neutral state or a neutral institution, because all institutions and states are made up of people, and people have their own interests, and people have, you know, political ambitions, desires, goals, and those political goals don't always align with the goals of other people in that country. So there's a kind of friend-enemy distinction that kind of emerges there. And so when you have that friend-enemy distinction at large, you kind of can't have absolute free speech, because ultimately it will lead to the collapse of the current power structure. And that's not in the interest of the people in the power structure. Now, in a way, I find it surprising that this person who held the placard has been found innocent, because Britain has shown itself to be somewhere that doesn't care about free speech anymore.
Right. We're living in crazy times.
Yeah, the concept was born here, but it's been completely lost in our country for various reasons. But I think that what we forget about free speech is it can't just exist in a vacuum. It has to exist in a country that is well governed and well run and led by wise and prudent people. And our country isn't, unfortunately.
Clearly. Right. Final answer. The question of the day for me, Charlie, and I suspect I know the answer to this. What institutions do you still have faith in?
Let me think. None.
I think that
let me tell you, actually. No, Sonia, let me tell you. I've got faith.
We have a minute. Go on. You can tell me in a minute.
I've got faith in one lone institution, and that is the pub. Because the pub is the most important British institution to ever exist, because it's where our country comes together to set the world to rights. And it's where the fabric of our country exists. And it's the last place that you can go and feel like you are truly among your own.
Oh, the pub is truly a British institution. The very thing they tried to stop us congregating in over C19. Charlie, it has been an absolute pleasure. I love people who know their own mind. I don't have to agree with it, but it's been a pleasure having you on with us today on Tuesday's edition of The Sonia Poulton Show. We'll be right back after the hour, everybody. This is Charlie Downs, and don't you ever tell him he sits on the fence about anything. Take good care of yourself, Charlie. Lovely to have you with us. We'll be right back.